You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, July 28th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor of History from Rutgers University, Jennifer Mittelstadt, on reimagining the welfare state. Also on the program today, the Senate's highway bill runs into a ditch on the way to the House. I made up that headline all by myself. Also on the program today, Boy Scouts end their ban on gay leaders, sort of. Religious folks still can discriminate. And Mike Huckabee tries to out-Trump Trump by essentially calling President Obama Hitler. And still, it is Donald Trump who is the buffoon in this race. Speaking of the buffoon, or that buffoon in this race, Donald Trump's lawyer apologizes for saying you cannot rape your spouse. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, everything I am saying is actual and true. It's not, there's no parody. This is not a satire show. This is not Halloween or April Fools. We're not doing our fake broadcast today. Donald Trump's lawyer, whoever that dude is, had to apologize for saying you cannot rape your spouse. Also, and I somehow missed it. Someone forwarded it to me from Chris Hayes had mentioned it, I guess, on Friday. Very good Medicare news out there from the Social Security Trustees report. And Chris Christie, the more they know him, the less they like him. At least in New Hampshire, the one place where they're supposed to like him. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. It's just, I don't know what to tell you. It's completely insane out there. It's just gone. It's, look, and I know I must sound like a broken record a little bit on this. Unfortunately, we took a vacation in the midst of, so some of the stuff is pre-recorded, so I didn't have the opportunity to keep tooting my own horn. But on the day Donald Trump entered the race, and the reason why I continue to talk about Trump in particular so much is because you can see what it is doing. This, he is not just running for president. He is fundamentally altering the physics of the Republican race and Republican politics. I mean, I think I had said just a couple of days ago, you know, at that debate, it's going to be they're all going to try and say something more crazy than Donald Trump when it comes to Iran. And it is already happening. Now, we're going to go, we'll dig into the Huckabee stuff later in the program, but the thing to keep in mind in here is that it's not just about, let's call up some Holocaust survivors and a couple of Jewish organizations to find out if it's appropriate to say the word ovens. We just had a presidential candidate, a guy who, what, came in second in Iowa last time around, Huckabee, 08, who just essentially called the president Hitler. Now, Ben Carson has come very close to this line, but it just reinforces my point that while the media wants to focus and say Trump is some type of crazy guy for the stuff he says, look at the other Republican candidates. This is the Republican Party. This is the Republican Party. Huckabee won Iowa in 2008. So every time you see any reporter talk about what a joke, and frankly, you know, I like the folks over at Huffington Post, but to put Donald Trump on the entertainment page, then you better put every other Republican candidate on there as well. Mike Huckabee has more credibility than Donald Trump? No, they're both morons. And they both say the most ridiculous things. And just watch. It's only going to get worse from here. And the problem with this, why this isn't just about horse races and whatnot, is that on some level, this is going to dramatically impact what happens with this Iran deal. Now, it may just make it more polarized and in some ways, make it easier for the Democrats to continue to support President Obama on this. I mean, that could actually be the sort of the upshot of this. You know, when all of a sudden the opponents of this deal are morons and are advertising the fact that they're morons, that's good for the deal. John McCain has now got to sit with all the guys he invited to the table back in 2008 when he chose, I can't even remember her name now, Sarah Palin as his vice presidential nominee. He invited all these guys to the table. In fact, not only did he invite all these guys to the table, he gave them all high chairs. Because if she can do it, you can do it. And so he chose someone who was destined to be a flash in the pan reality TV star, and what he essentially incubated was a real reality TV star who decides, I'm just going to head back into the presidential race, and his name is Donald Trump. And because that guy is so successful in the Republican Party, Mike Huckabee has to start basically saying President Obama's like Hitler, bringing the Israelis into the gas chambers. I mean, I find the whole thing, I got to say, hilarious. And I'm just hoping that at the end of the day, we can make some, I don't even know if it's lemons that we got, but we're going to get some lemonade out of this. I'm quite convinced of it. Folks, when I contemplate, like I do every day, firing Michael, one of the things I've got to contemplate is how I'm going to replace him. Well, I think we have moved. Don't get so upset. Don't get so upset.
Did Michael just get fired?
No, Michael didn't just get fired. But I got to say, the program today is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. And one of the things I'm thinking, like, what if I let Michael go? How would I replace him? And now I think there's a problem for Michael, because ZipRecruiter, look, I don't know when the best time to hire people is. Apparently, it's the summer, because according to ZipRecruiter, competitors are on vacation. There's less competition for quality candidates. And the trouble when I'm looking for somebody to replace, let's say, just hypothetically speaking, Michael, is that I really don't know how to go about doing it. Well, ZipRecruiter will allow you to post your job opening once, and they send it to over 100 plus job boards. Monster, Job.com, Facebook, Glassdoor, CareerJet, all of these ones. And then you get an easy user interface where you see all the new candidates roll in. In addition to ZipRecruiter matching what you're seeking with resumes they have on file, over 4 million resumes. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses. Here is just one testimonial. It's not from Michael's mom. Come on, don't get so upset.
I just didn't understand that one.
Okay.
It didn't make sense.
Go ahead. It did make sense, but at the end. I tried ZipRecruiter for the first time. Couldn't believe how easy it was to choose well-qualified candidates. I've been in business since 1987. Used all means possible. Unemployment office ads and local newspaper, Craigslist, none can compare. I will continue to use ZipRecruiter. It's the best. That's from a guy named Janae Gomez. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/majority, and you can use it for free. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Jennifer Mittelstadt. She is a professor of history at Rutgers University, author of The Forthcoming Rise of the Military Welfare State, which should be out in October, and talking about her piece, Reimagining the Welfare State in Jacobin. Issue of Jacobin, or you can find it on jacobinmag.com. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So in these parts, we're big fans of the New Deal. But I think there is an awareness that the part of the way the New Deal got passed was if it left a lot of people behind. But you make that point, I think, in a more explicit way in this piece. When we think about the New Deal, first off, give us a sense of what it was so that we can talk about who was specifically left out.
Okay. Well, the first thing I want to say, Sam, is I am a fan of the New Deal, too, just as I'm a fan of lots of things that are flawed or imperfect. So the New Deal is really the name that we put on a collection of programs that range from everything from labor protections to social insurance to public assistance to public works programs, you know, jobs created by the government, all of which came about in the years while FDR was president that promised a more secure and safer economic and social environment for Americans. So it's hard to keep all of those together in your mind, but that's really the panoply of programs that we are thinking about and trying to hold in our minds when we're thinking about the New Deal.
And so let's talk about, I think what your piece did, and I don't want to get ahead of myself here, but it brought into clarity just sort of how this happened and how sort of, I guess, shrouded it is as to who it leaves out and why, or I guess why is fairly somewhat straightforward, but how it goes about. So let's talk about the sort of the exclusions and inequities, as you write about, that were sort of embedded in these New Deal programs.
Well, one of the things that's helpful for me when I think about this, and for most historians when we think about the past, is when we're trying to evaluate something to like the New Deal is to ask the question, for whom, right? And so when we think about evaluating the New Deal, I think the question to ask is, for whom was it a deal? And then it really brings into sharp focus these exclusions that I write about. So the New Deal was a deal for people who worked in what I would think of as regular industrial jobs or regular salaried jobs, what we might think of as more like full-time employment for larger firms. And at the time, in the 1930s, these were way disproportionately, perhaps nearly exclusively, jobs for men and mostly jobs for white men. And these were the jobs that were brought under labor protections. These were the jobs that were most likely to be unionized and then fall under the union protections. These were the jobs that were written into the Social Security program. Social insurance is actually both old age insurance, what we think of as Social Security, but also unemployment insurance. And these were the positions that all came under protection from the New Deal. And so if you were one of the people who held those jobs, the New Deal was quite a deal for you, and we shouldn't underestimate it. It was probably the best deal common people in the United States had ever had before, but it was limited. So those people who fell outside of that were the people who were excluded from the New Deal, and we can talk a little bit, if you like, about who those were and why those exclusions happened.
Yes, I want to, because you know I have, you know, we've said broadly, I think on this program many times in the past, mentioned that in many respects, women and we'll talk about that and minorities were cut out of the New Deal, and people have emailed me and said, how did that happen? I mean, was there just a law excluding them as people? But no, it was this sort of backdoor way. And there was a total consciousness, right, of the lawmakers at the time as to who was, instead of saying it's for these people or those people, it's for these positions. And there was a total consciousness as to who held those positions, right?
That's right. I sort of think about it as, when we think about the exclusions, it's the, on the one hand, there's sort of a lack of imagination or a limited imagination on the part of the architects of the New Deal. On the other hand, there's some sort of cynical political trading. So let me talk first about the lack of imagination. I think the reason why women really are cut out of the New Deal and receive unequal benefits from it and limited benefits from it is because both lawmakers and the bureaucrats who crafted the New Deal behind the scenes, when they imagined sort of the ideal system of social and economic security, they imagined a male breadwinner who earned enough to support his wife and family. And this had been the goal, really, of reformers in the labor movement since, the progressive era. So this is what they hoped and dreamed, and the New Deal gave them an opportunity to do that. What that meant was that benefits flowed purposely toward male heads of households and bolstering male heads of households. And the idea was that women and children would be dependent on these men and would receive social and economic security through them. For non-whites, which is the other large group of Americans who are left out, I would say it's probably less of an imagination and more of real political deal-making with Southern and Western lawmakers who did not want to see their low-wage labor forces, mostly in agriculture, brought under the protections of the New Deal in any way. And in a way, what scholarship shows now is that new dealers traded their votes to get their votes for industrial workers, mostly in the urban north, and salaried workers in order to leave out those people who worked in agriculture or in domestic labor and in these kinds of positions. So I think that those might be the two why explanations. And then when you look at the New Deal, there's a lot of different ways that those exclusions then produced real inequality for both women and for non-whites.
I want to go into that, but I just want to note for people that last week we spoke to Harold Meyerson, who had written a piece about the history of the South functioning to depress wages across the board through time, I should say, starting, of course, with the idea of no wages and then continuing that tradition throughout. And on some level, this is, I mean, what you're describing here is another, is sort of a chapter in that, but one that I would think was at least in part, if not for the most part, a function of also denying. I mean, how much was it? Was it racism? Or I mean, I guess it's sort of the same question about slavery, right? I mean, how much was it just pure on racism, and how much was it they just want cheap labor? It really is sort of both is embedded in it.
You're absolutely right, Sam. I mean, you're right to see this in a chapter in the long effort to depress wages, and it's also right to place it in the long chapter, an ongoing chapter of racism in the United States. And probably trying to pick them apart isn't as helpful as trying to see the ways that they're intertwined with one another. And in fact, racism is a tool to keep wages depressed, and depressed wages are a tool that you can use against a group of people you're quite prejudiced against. And I think both are happening in this case. In the South, if you write just the way that this works by keeping wages low, right? If you keep African Americans out of the labor protections, if you keep them out of these social insurance programs, then they are in a vulnerable economic position, which is exactly what landowners and employers in the South and the West and agriculture wanted. They wanted a vulnerable labor force that they could bring in and out seasonally that wouldn't have another place to turn. So they didn't also, they didn't only fight incorporation into the labor protections and into Social Security. It's worth noting that they also really fought against the public works programs, which were things like the Public Works Administration, the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps. All of those were another way that the New Deal reached citizens, providing them with some economic security in return for doing public work. And even those programs were highly suspect in the South and the West to the degree that they employed African Americans. And of course, some of these programs, like the Civilian Conservation Corps, actually operated segregated camps and used differential pay scales for African Americans and for whites. That was most notable in the National Recovery Administration.
So at one point in the piece, you actually quote a DuPont vice president who was an early member of the Liberty League, writing to a political sympathizer about the, quote, five Negroes on my place in South Carolina who refused to work this spring, saying they had easy jobs with the government. So on some level, that those type of government projects were sort of the, I guess, the leaky part of this, right? I mean, where it's one thing to say, okay, we're going to make sure that these that Social Security benefits, that New Deal benefits are only available for people who have these jobs, knowing that those jobs are located primarily in the North, are staffed by people who are primarily white males. But there are some places where it gets a little leaky, like these government projects.
That's right. And another place where we might say it gets leaky is in public assistance, which is also created during the New Deal. When we think of public assistance, now we have the Temporary Aid to Needy Families program, but it used to be called Aid to Dependent Children. There's also Aid to the Blind, Old Age Assistance. Those were also what you might say leaky in the sense that they, in theory, apply to all Americans. One of the compromises, though, that's even made there with the South is that states will have a lot of discretion setting both the terms by which people qualify, but also the amount of money which people receive. And so in the South, of course, they use that discretion in order to deny public assistance to African Americans. This was particularly notable around the time of planting or harvesting when local public welfare officials would throw African Americans off the rolls in order to force them back into the fields to work.
So walk us through some of these. It's how women and minorities, I mean, you mentioned part of it there, but walk us through more of that, how they were specifically left out of these benefits.
Well, if we go back to women and we go back to that point about the sort of male breadwinner ideal that New Dealers have in their minds when they construct these programs, one of the ironies of it is that it's at odds with what's actually happening with women at that point in time. So we think of the big surge of women in the labor market coming in the 1960s and 1970s, and that's true. However, in the 1930s, women are increasing their share in the labor market, and they roughly number somewhere between a quarter and almost a third of working people in the United States. Nevertheless, the programs that are created in the New Deal, let's take those public works programs again, the PWA, the WPA, I know it's an alphabet soup, sort of. But women do have access to those, but at a far, far fewer of them. So although women are, as I said, this quarter or third of the labor market, the public works programs that are created, about 12 to 14% are created for women. And those that are created are in the sex-segregated jobs. So they're in domestic service. They're in sewing. They're in gardening. They're in dental assistant positions. So they're in positions that tend to reinforce a lower position in the labor market and, of course, make it harder for them to support their families because they don't have access to public works.
What is the mechanism? I mean, because you say, like, you know, the way you just phrased it was that only 12 to 14% of these jobs were created for women. But it wasn't that they were created for women, right? It was they were created in fields where women actually had some measurable amount of participation.
Yes.
Is that, I mean,
both.
Is that right?
Yes, to both. Sometimes okay. They were created in fields where, in other words, women, for example, joined, if we think of the Works Progress Administration projects that were in theater and in the arts and things like that, both women and men were in those. But the heavy construction jobs, which were the bulk of public works jobs, were purposefully created for men. And of course, it wasn't illegal to discriminate in hiring at this point
right.
in time. That doesn't come until the late 60s and 1970s, where it's enforceable. So it's utterly common to look at a job ad in the paper, for example, and there's a separate section for men's jobs and a separate section for women's jobs. That lasts all the way up through the 1970s in the United States. So the government basically can do the same thing. It will hire for women, and it will hire for men, and public works jobs, some are created explicitly and solely for women, and some are created for men. Others can hire both, depending on what the area is. So it's not solely by happenstance, in other words, that fewer jobs are created for women. It is also by design. And it is, again, that design that's part of the imagination that it is male breadwinners who really need to be bolstered, because if their salaries are higher, if their security is better, then their wives and children will also be more secure.
Well, what was, I mean, this is a bit of an aside, but what was driving, I mean, I guess my sense has always been that the first big push for women entering the workforce was during the war. What was driving participation, women participating in the 1930s? Was it simply just a sense of general emancipation, or was there something else at play?
Well, I think there are two things at play. It depends on which women you're talking about. If you're looking at middle class and educated women, of whom there are far more after the Progressive Era in the 1920s, then, and actually the 1930s is a time of great education for women and men who are trying to stay out of the labor force and get educated if they can. Then you're seeing people who are going into the professions, and I think this is really for achievement. It's for their own betterment. and for the bettering of society. But most women, as today, enter the workforce out of economic necessity. And that's really what's happening during the 1930s and why you see an increase in women's labor force participation. Men are losing jobs, and women, even married women, are trying to step up and fill in the gaps in order to keep their families afloat. And so there's an irony that at this really difficult economic moment, women who are becoming more important in the workforce and becoming more important in their family economies are actually discriminated against, both in the labor force and by the New Deal, which probably makes it more difficult for all of these families to get by, not just for women.
Do you think that was an irony, or actually there was some type of sort of causal connection there? Like, on some level, was there sort of a general sense at that time, like, there's, you know, men are in some type of malaise and we need to sort of reorient society so that men can get their mojo back?
I've never quite put it that way, Sam, but I think you've really hit on something. There really was a sense that the Depression was a crisis for men. It was a crisis for families. There was a higher rate of it wasn't a higher rate of divorce, actually, because people couldn't afford divorces, but there was a higher rate of desertion. Families were falling apart, and there was a sense that a lot of this came from men's shame and humiliation at not being able to support their families during the crisis. And so there really was a sense of urgency, almost a psychological and social sense of urgency about the need to support men. So the ideology of supporting a male breadwinner, while it has a history, is given a greater urgency in this context. So it is by design, in that sense, that women are thought to be not as deserving or not as needy of the scarce positions that do exist or the new social welfare that's being created.
You know, and let's talk about Social Security, because the this dynamic that you point out in this, you know, just sort of is just one more thing. As you know, as a child in the, or as a young child in the 70s, you know, so I still have a recollection of you're in my city, you weren't allowed to vote. You couldn't register to vote with unless you had your husband's name if you're a woman, or that. Your credit, I think that was around the time, like, well, if you were a woman, you could actually get your own credit card soon, or somewhere around then. But Social Security, that was sort of baked into the cake as well with that dynamic.
That's right. So if you happen to be a woman who held a full-time salaried position in a covered area of employment, you too would pay into Social Security, as would your employer. However, if you were married, you would not, upon your retirement, receive those benefits. You would instead receive the benefits of your husband, who presumably had also paid into Social Security. And since he worked most likely at a higher wage than you had, actually would have a higher Social Security payment. What that meant, actually, was that married women's Social Security was funneled back into the general revenues of the program in order to fund other male-headed households. Because Social Security, as you know, I don't know if most Americans know, I sometimes think they don't, it's not a one-to-one actuarial basis. The government subsidizes what it is that you and your employer put into the program, of course. And it did from the start. So women's Social Security earnings, if they were married, went back into the general revenues. And that didn't change until the time that you're sort of thinking about, in the late 60s and 1970s, when women start to open people's eyes to the inequities that they face, not only in the labor market or in society in general, but within the New Deal, right? They start to point out, here are the places we've been left out of an equal standing in the welfare state. Here's a place where we are not first-class citizens, and we want to be. And so through a series of legal challenges and changes in law and administrative rules, women came to receive their own Social Security benefits as their husbands did.
That to me is fascinating, both because of what we know now, or the way that, you know, marriage is sort of is privileged in our society in most arenas, in terms of taxes, in terms of other benefits. I mean, that is that's just fascinating. And of course, it also meant if you were a woman, like, hey, good luck leaving your husband if you're anywhere near retirement, or you are broke.
Well, that's right. I mean, the real difficulty of a system that imagined that women would, in the best case scenario, always be dependent on men is that then if they weren't dependent on men, they found themselves in quite a difficult situation. In theory, they could turn to public assistance, but that, of course, was a means-tested, very minimal program that doesn't provide anything like the first-class benefits that a social insurance program would provide. So it does build a kind of dependence of women on husbands, on families, into the welfare state from its beginning.
And I know, I mean, you touch on the topic of your book, which is the sort of the almost the parallel welfare state created by the military. Let's table that for the moment, because we'll have you back in October or November when your book comes out. But I want to talk about how these sort of the way that these inequalities that were sort of set up from the beginning, how they have sort of, I guess, been communicated through the ages when you have this sort of parallel track of welfare, right? Because we have the one thing that is not welfare, it's Social Security and all the benefits that we got out of the New Deal. And, of course, we don't you mentioned Susan Mettler, and we had her on to talk about her her book on the submerged state and all the sort of 98-99% of us are on the dole in one form or another. But none of that is welfare in our lexicon. Just basically what certain groups of people get is welfare for the sort of broadly speaking. How did this dynamic reinforce that?
Well, I think that's a really good point, Sam. I think it's challenging and it's difficult to trace, but it's worth taking the time to do it. What the New Deal does, basically, by selecting certain jobs in the labor market for social protections, it actually turns those into what we would think of now as good jobs in the primary labor market. That is, those are the jobs that come with social protections, and other jobs don't come with those social protections. So it sort of doubles down on what was already an advantage that people who are working those jobs might have by making them more secure. What happens, and it's interesting, is after World War II, there's a great accord between labor, which is now powerful, much more powerful than it had been before because of the New Deal, and corporations, in which they sort of decide that there will be a private welfare state alongside the public welfare state. And those we might think of, in most Americans think of those, as just their employment benefits. But those private employment benefits for salaried workers and for workers, let's say, in the industrial industries like the car industry, those are actually subsidized through tax breaks from the government to encourage private employers to provide things, for example, like health insurance to their employees or pensions to their employees. And what happens then is that those who already had, coming out of the New Deal, government protections and Social Security, have more. There's more built onto that existing privileged position as time goes on. And so that is, I think, one of the ways that we see the initial divisions that are created by the New Deal accentuated by the kind of patchwork, sort of hodgepodge of other social welfare programs that are created in the United States afterward.
And what's fascinating, too, is that, you know, give me your sense, if it's not the case that part of the impetus for things like, in particular, let's say pensions, which, you know, no one under the age of 30 would understand that there was a time in this country where a lot of workers, not all workers, and we're talking about that explicitly, but could get a defined benefit pension, which meant that you put money in and you knew exactly what you were going to get out. I would imagine the existence of Social Security basically created some competitive pressure for private industry to add more to that. And then government made it easier, like you say, by providing tax breaks for them to do that. But the incentive, the impetus has to be like, well, look, you don't give me a pension, I can go into this other job and I already have at least one leg of that three-legged stool. You know, it's up to you to give me another leg.
I think that that's right. And that's a good way to think about it. Often, public social welfare programs, government-provided social welfare programs, can sort of operate as a catalyst or an impetus for programs in the private sector that are probably more generous, and as a way to lure necessary workers when you need them. I think one of the questions that we have now is what has that meant in a period when we have higher unemployment, when we have deindustrialization, when we have outsourcing and privatizing of jobs? That pressure really no longer exists in the private sector to try to really lure wide swaths of the populace into, you know, good industrial jobs, for example. So those are less operative now. But during the 1940s and 1950s and even into the early 1960s, those were quite powerful and created another form of private security for those who already benefited from the New Deal in really important and valuable ways.
And so then you you talk about how it's been documented how white and mostly male communities of workers and homeowners rejected African-American claims to social protections that they already had gotten, basically. So when we talk about expanding the reach of union-protected jobs or federal housing authority loans, access to public hospitals and schools, there is sort of a fear. And it seems like, you know, we see this dynamic play out all the time. Like, I don't want those folks to get this stuff because it's probably going to come out of what I'm getting.
Right. And this actually just refers right back to what you were saying earlier about how some things are considered welfare and some are not. Most of the programs of the New Deal, and then those coming out of World War II, like the GI Bill, for example, the expansion of federal home loans during the late 40s and 1950s in order to create the suburbs, the tax breaks for home ownership, and things like that. None of that was ever considered welfare. It was considered part of first-class citizenship for the mostly men and mostly white men who received it. What happened is that social movements of women and African Americans, which were developing in the 1950s and 1960s, looked around and, yes, they're looking for civil and political and legal rights, but they're also looking for social and economic rights. First-class citizenship, it's quite clear, means access to the kind of social and economic security that white men have. And as they demand access to those programs and gain access to those programs, those who are on the inside, who already have access to them to a surprising degree, are nervous about it, at best, hostile about it, I think, at worst. These are people who, in the late 1960s, were called the forgotten men of the white working class, or they were called Reagan Democrats a little bit later on, but people who felt very vulnerable about the idea of having additional people covered by welfare programs or additional programs that hadn't existed before being created for people who had slightly different needs than their needs because they occupied a different position in the workforce or lived in a different place or had a different standard of health or what have you. But it created a real political backlash that I think is rarely seen in clear-eyed fashion, actually by those at the time or since then, and even, frankly, by some historians.
I mean, it's fascinating, and I can't wait, frankly, to read your book, because I think the way the GI Bill operated, and let's just touch on this just briefly, if we can, to just sort of further cement this dynamic. The GI Bill gives you low-cost mortgages. It gives you low-interest loans. It gives you cheap higher education and all these benefits. Well, obviously, if you're a woman, you're a lot less likely to get the GI Bill because at the time you can't join the army. If you're an African American, you're not able to avail yourself of these things because you're redlined out of the housing. You can get low cost loans if you could get a loan. You're not allowed into most of these universities. So all you're supposedly included, but you're excluded essentially. And that's really sort of the dynamic that's sort of the perfect metaphor, if not really, it's not even a metaphor, it's just another example of this dynamic.
I think you're right. So you're talking about two things. There's sort of the obvious discrimination that does exist in some programs, and then there's the less obvious, what we might think of as social and institutional discrimination that is existing at the same time that could make something that could be a social right inoperable because you can't actually access it. So yes, in the case of the GI Bill, there were about 500,000 or so women who volunteered in the WACs or WAVES or what have you. And they were not told that they were qualified for the GI Bill to the same degree as men were. And African Americans also, about only a third of African Americans who served in World War II were actually informed that they were eligible for the GI Bill, and probably only half of women, whereas closer to 90% of white men who volunteered were actively informed that they were eligible for the GI Bill and encouraged to pursue it. So that's that obvious sort of discrimination, but then you're right. If you even qualified for it and you went after it, you might also face discrimination in where you could go to school, where you could use your veterans loan to buy a house, et cetera.
And just the opportunities, I think, to just sort of end up qualifying are less too, right?
Yes.
And all right, so let's just briefly touch on this notion of, I mean, you say the danger is in being too nostalgic for the New Deal. And I guess presumably that's because it clouds our understanding of just how many people were sort of left out of that deal and the implications it has had carrying forward. So moving forward from here, in terms of a broad principle, what should we be looking at when we talk about a new deal, as it were?
Well, first of all, Sam, just a disclaimer that historians are notoriously terrible at predicting the future or crafting plans for the future. So I don't pretend to have any wonderful blueprint. But I do think that we can take lessons from the past without being nostalgic for it. And so I think one of the things that we really need to consider as we think about the future of social and economic security in this country is a fully inclusionary program, a program that doesn't allow for first-class citizenship for some people and second-class citizenship for others. And I think this means not just paying passing attention to, but giving fundamental attention to movements that are occurring now, like the, you know, $15 per hour minimum wage movement that is being passed by popular referenda across the country. It's being pushed for by low-wage fast food workers. I think we need to take seriously the movement of the worker centers, which are workers in low-wage jobs that are bypassing or circumventing traditional unions, which haven't really reached out to them, and instead are organizing around the real social and economic needs that all the workers in a given low-wage sector might have. So they're paying attention to on-the-job stuff, but they're also paying attention to, how do I find affordable housing? How do I get health care? they're paying attention to all of these things. I think we need to take seriously the immigration movement, which, yes, is a movement for full citizenship, but it's also a movement for full citizenship in that full sense, right? Not just to have papers, right, but to have all of the social and economic security that comes with being a quote-unquote documented person in the United States. And even the Black Lives Matter movement, which is primarily about policing, it's also about having full social and economic rights so that the neighborhoods that you live in are these safer and more secure, stable neighborhoods, fairer neighborhoods that don't set up these situations in the first place. So I think really looking at full equity for all Americans is a fundamental for looking forward and thinking about a true full social welfare state.
Jennifer Mittelstadt, the piece is Reimagining the Welfare State. It's in Jacobin Magazine. We will link to it at majority.fm. And your book, Rise of the Military Welfare State, as you probably know, is coming out in October. So thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. We will head into the fun half of the program once again, giving you, wow, 12 minutes of extra content. God, just give. And then and it doesn't end. In the fun half, what do? We did, like, we went, like 45 minutes over yesterday.
We have not, am I even up? Hold on. We have not had a normal length show, and I can't even tell you how many months.
Every single day
we go over to the 130 time.
Oh, my God.
We just give so much.
How is it possible? How is it possible?
This show has gone from 12 to 130 to 12 to 145.
It's now
like 12 to 2.
Today the program is going to be, the fun half is going to be even that much longer because I'm going to complain about my babysitter.
You found out what happened?
Yeah.
You found out what happened?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to take it to the air. I'm not going to say
her
name.
Did you know what happened, Michael?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm excited.
It's incredible. But wait, people don't even know the setups. They got to hear the whole thing on the fun half.
Yeah, so you got to become a member to hear about Sam's babysitter. Don't forget, folks.
That sounds really problematic.
Yeah.
You got to become a member to hear about Sam's babysitter.
That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, it is your support that allows me to complain about my babysitter situation. For literally less than 50 cents a day, you can ensure that I have the opportunity to vent about my babysitter.
And now you can hear me vent about my baby, too.
We juggle, you know, the problem is that we had a... Oh, come on. You got to get your own show to complain about your own kids. You can't just... You can't do that. You got to... There has to be, like, a different way. It has to be, like, sort of a... We have to do a sideways way in which you complain about your kids.
Maybe it'll be a secondary podcast.
That's right.
Welcome back to Matt Pitches.
That's right. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to announce that we're starting our new YouTube channel so that Matt can complain about his
kids. Parenting 101 right. With Matt Binder.
Well, I would say probably Parenting 01. We're quite up to 101. Folks, just pennies a day allow you to support this program so that we can give you both the great content of a professor like Jennifer Mittelstadt and then the, you know, not so great content of me complaining about my baby. Although this story is a little bit off the hook. I mean, it is crazy. And I think we're karmically paying. We had such a great babysitter when Saul was first a kid, or maybe when he's still a kid, but I mean like when he was like I think 6 months old. Leslie was such a great babysitter, I think, that we're sort of karmically now paying that off. That's what I'm convinced.
Let's get to the better half so we can hear it.
So we're going to take a break. We'll head into the better half. Folks, remember ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Use it for free. Go check it out. Small business, medium-sized business, you're going to find it much easier to hire good people. Michael, why are you so nervous? Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Get the Majority Report blend. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it. Always use it to buy your Amazon crap. If you buy crap from Amazon, we get a kickback. Don't forget, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. Pick up the app, majorityapp.com. Okay. She's a predator who says no, 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 no. Just a little dog, and she knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the night time through she says no, 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 no. If I ask her to walk with me, she says you're only afraid to lose me. She'll say no, 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 no. She'll say no.